Welcome to the Friends with Money podcast, brought to you by Money Magazine, creating financial freedom for Australians since 1999.
Welcome, everyone, to The Hot Seat, a special episode of the Friends with Money podcast. I'm your host, Michelle Baltazar, editor-in-chief at Money Magazine. Today, we are joined by Stephen Hunt, the author of a new book called Find, Build, Sell, How I Turned a $100 Backyard Bar into a $100 Million Pub Empire, and the chief executive of Hunt Hospitality. Welcome to Friends with Money, Stephen.
Thanks, Michelle. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us, where are you right now? Are you, given that you have a $100 million pub empire and you're still working? So what's going on? You're not retiring at all?
No, I think it's funny because a lot of people think that when you have your own business, that's when the work stops. But I think sometimes that's when the work begins because you're responsible. So I don't even think I'd like to retire. You know, that's something that is a fair way off for me. So I hope, anyway.
That's it. I guess if it's something you're passionate about, there's no such thing as retiring or moving away from it, right?
I love it. I have to stop myself and have to bring some disciplines in from jumping out of bed in the morning and getting straight on the computer and tapping away. You know, I did that for many years, and then I just kind of went, okay, just because I love it. You know what I mean? So it's really important part of my life, hospitality, and that, yeah, it's loving your job is crucial to success, I think.
Absolutely. Now, I have read your book and I'm really inspired by a lot of the kind of words of wisdom that you've shared there. I've even put in post-it notes on the really interesting stuff, like you had here, how to speak lawyer. So when they say, we can advise you against that, but it's your decision, what they really mean is, don't do it.
Yeah,
you know, so... There's like a page here of what they actually mean when they say something that's a bit of lawyerly, if you like. So now I just wanted to ask you about your, let's say, your money advice for our readers. But first, trying to get to know you a little bit more, can you tell us what was your first job?
My first job was working for my parents, actually. So I did a lot of gardening at home. I think I was probably, when I started, probably about 8 or 9. So I would literally go around my parents' yard and back then you didn't have the old blower, so you'd use a broom. And then I'd tidy up in the garden and didn't do the mowing but sort of prune some of the trees and things like that. And then, yeah, that was, I remember saying to my dad after I had probably a couple of grand saved up within a couple of years, despite the fact they weren't good payers, but that's what every family does. So anyway, I said to my dad, I've got, a few grand, what should I do with it? And at the time he was like, term deposits were paying well, but it was safe. And he just said, put it in your term deposit. Just put it in that for the time being. So, so washing and cleaning up at home was the very first job.
That sounds like a good way to start, because at least you know your bosses, right? They can't fire you.
I don't know. Sometimes I think you thought about, only being 8 and pretty active, I'd easily wander. So, but no, he was a good mentor.
Now, what's the best money advice you've ever received, other than the term deposits maybe? Was that a good advice?
Term deposits was, yeah, that was really good. And then I guess money advice to actually how you earn it is to find a career that you really, really enjoy. And then in terms of now where we are with, capital expenditure, I'm sorry if I digress a little bit, but we're really conscious of making sure that the end result is better for the customer. So we're very conscious of not overcapitalizing. And so I guess that comes back to what you really should do with your own money. The best advice is just be very cautious about it and sort of, spend it extremely wisely.
I like it. Do not overcapitalize. I think a lot of people tripped over that during COVID, certainly, where they just didn't have enough left after spending too much. What's the best investment decision you've made?
I believe it was setting up my pub fund. So I'd had a bit of success with a real estate property in Sydney, and in 2015 I found a pub that I really wanted to buy, and I invested in that, and that was the start of the escalation of the fund and to where I am today. It was really quick, but that was probably the best investment I had. My wife would disagree, and she would say the best investment that I had was marrying her in Ireland, where she's from. So it would be that money spent.
Well, I don't know her, but I agree with her. I think, you know, finding that lifelong partner is the best investment you'd ever make for yourself, right?
Yeah.
Now, what is the worst investment? So what is the worst?
Well, it was a bad investment, but it actually worked out okay. So it was buying a Maserati on a whim that I'd driven past numerous times, and for the ATO, it was on June 29. Actually, I didn't buy it. The company bought it. So, you know, it's a beautiful car and I love driving it, but they're expensive to run, you know. And normally they sort of go down in value significantly, but probably the positive out of this car, and it was sheer luck, was the fact that the engine in it was the last engine made by the Ferrari warehouse. So it's going to go up in value the longer I keep it for, because now they actually make Maserati engines in a different area. So bad decision at the time. It looks like hopefully it'll work out to be a good one.
I do feel there's a little bit of Irish luck there, I must say.
Yeah.
Maserati, I would love to be able to drive a Maserati. Did you feel like it's good to drive, or, you know, it's no different to, say, I don't know, a Toyota Corolla?
Well, it's just super comfortable. And you know, they've spared no expense in the extra things that they supply for you in the car. Like, it's, you know, the stitching on the seats, it's just really, really comfortable. But having said that, and it is beautiful to drive, I actually drive an Amarok in between all of our venues, because occasionally I bring stock from one pub to the other. So I try not to drive the Maserati, and have these thoughts every once in a while, I should sell it. And then I get in the car and drive, and I'm like, no, I'm not going to sell this. So.
Can't do it. Not even with petrol price going up to above $2.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That hurts.
Now, I mentioned earlier that you've just published a book called Find, Build, Sell, and how you turned a $100 backyard bar into a $100 million pub empire. So tell us, what would you say to someone right now who would say, oh, well, I don't believe you. That's just kind of, everything just kind of worked together in your favor. But can they really start with a capital of $1,000, $10,000?
Absolutely. So it started out where we had a barbecue area back at my parents' house. And at the age of 16 and 17, where most people were studying for their HSC, my parents occasionally would go away on a holiday. And so I took that as a great opportunity to have my friends over and to entertain them. And it kind of blew out of all, not blew out of all proportion, but it became such a sort of a really good thing, getting, you know, we had jocks and we had, you know, techie, the beginning of the tech guys. We sort of had all sorts of walks of life that would come to my house, and we have a few beers, and then, you know, we cook a barbecue, and then quite often there was a few beers left in the fridge. So for the next barbecue, we would sell those beers to people and make a little bit of pocket money. And, you know, I was dancing and carrying on. It was really good fun. And so then I actually got a job in a pub that was up the road from the school I went to. And the people I learnt from at the time, and this is saying you can do anything if you want to, and it's put yourself in the right room. So I actually was taught by some of the best publicans in Australia. And as an 18-year-old, I didn't really, you know, pay much attention to it because I was going into work, doing a job. But then I started paying more and more attention to it, and then really fell in love with the industry. And in terms of turning $100 into $1,000, that comes with being with the right people and finding the right room. And so it started with industry associations. So I met a lot of intelligent people there. And then because I have a fund at the time, I was like, well, hang on, I can't afford to buy these businesses or to establish a fund. So then I started looking at the fund side of it. And as I was doing that, I was getting more educated. So I was going to TAFE, then university, then the grad cert at uni, and then ended up at Harvard. So that was a stepping stone all the way through. But you find, as I said, being in the right room, that's where your intelligence really grows. So certainly it is achievable, but you have to have the want. And it took me 23 years in the industry, so I was only a novice, to actually work out how to set up the fund and then to escalate to where we are today.
I like that advice. It truly is, when you say being in the right room, the company you keep, you know, you want to be surrounded by people who will push you to do big things. Otherwise, you know, you are kind of limited to experiences if you're in the wrong room. Now, talking about money, what would you do if you only had $50 left in the bank?
If I didn't have a job, I would buy nice clothes. I know it's only $50, but I really, really would try to present myself quite well with what I had. Funny story, when I was in London and worked there for a year, I had to buy a white shirt. The recruiters there said, Steve, the guy you've got the interview with, he's a really tough old Irishman. But they said, wear a nice shirt. And I was like, I don't really have a nice shirt. So I went to Oxfam and bought a tuxedo shirt. And I didn't have any cufflinks, so that was expensive. So I just rolled the sleeves up a little bit and then put a jumper on and went to the meeting, got the job, and learnt a phenomenal amount in that period. But I think at the time that I worked with him, but I think presenting yourself well to start with puts you a step ahead, despite what I just said, puts you a step ahead of anyone else, and then obviously applying for a job. So I'd spend the $50, you know, potentially on as nice clothes as you possibly can get with that.
Did you end up talking to that person who employed you that you spent that money to buy something to impress him later on?
Yeah, we had a really open and honest relationship. I had a smile when I think about it. We had a lot of good fun, and he didn't mention it. When I mentioned it to him, he just sort of smiled wryly. Wry smile.
I like that. That is such a good. That's such a good piece of advice, especially for the younger generations or those who are just up and coming, where you dress for the job you want, not the job you currently have.
Absolutely, and it's a classic saying of pride in presentation is pride in performance.
So, I agree.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier that you come from a big family. Mm-hmm. Do you intend to leave an inheritance?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think inheritance comes in many forms. And for sure, I'd love to leave some money to my children. You know, hopefully that's a long way off. But I think spending money on my children now to do with their education is kind of like dipping into the inheritance for the future. And then teaching them more about, you know, actually some of my kids may not go to uni. My two oldest daughters are at uni now. I've got three boys. Whether they choose to go to uni or not, we'll sort of guide them on it. But teaching them the basics about earning money and saving and then giving back to the community and to your sporting clubs, I think that's kind of like a form of inheritance, if you know what I mean. It's what you're actually teaching them when you're here. And then because that stays with them when you're gone, hopefully they make right decisions.
Sounds like a plan. I know that you get this question a lot, but a lot of pubs and bars have had to close. So what is the future of the pub industry when we have, you know, this situation of a pandemic really putting a lot of publicans under pressure?
I think the future is going to be a lot of innovation to do with pubs. It's going to be bringing a lot of things from other industries. actually heard a really good story about a pub that had a massive function room, and they started having Zumba classes. So I see kind of innovations like that. I think the call and collect side of the business, I think that's probably going to stay. My advice to any publicans would be to obviously have a big cash stash there. Do you know what I mean? And just in case there is, you know, further on the pandemic, have great relationships with your stakeholders. We've got a really good relationship with our bank, also your suppliers. So growing those relationships, if you haven't already done that, is really, really important for COVID, and having that money set aside and looking at different things and just trialing different things. You know, trialing different things on your menu, trialing different cocktails. Hospitality is such a great industry because it just keeps growing. Do you know what I mean? Like back in the day when I first started working on the till, there was probably four buttons. You know, it was always schooner of beer, midi of beer, and maybe bourbon, you know, and rum or something like that. And the girls would come in and order a Pimm's and lemonade and be like, what is a Pimm's and lemonade? Like we just literally be. So the industry just keeps growing. You know, you've got really nice restaurants in it. So, you know, maybe upscale your restaurant or play to your right market. As I said, cocktails, functions, kind of the list is endless. And if you want to survive through COVID, you have to be looking after all of those things. Keep your eyes open.
I like that. I like that idea. I've heard of a local RSL club that had a massive wraparound balcony, and it used to be the smoker's area. But the restaurant manager said, well, instead of it being a smoker's area that gets used by maybe one or two individuals, you know, maybe for an hour, why don't we turn it into an herb and vegetable garden? And so people can see what they're eating. They can even, you know, the chef won't have to feel pressured when there's no, you know, whatever it is that they need. It's just there. And the RSL club said, great idea. Now you have to do it. So now he's doing the whole urban vegetable garden planning. But do you see that as the kind of innovation we'll see, which is kind of reflecting the new, you know, audiences or crowds that go to pubs and bars?
Oh, I think that's a fantastic innovation. I think it's really good, and it's flexible too. You know, if it works, you'll get a lot of people who go there to have a look, and people love homegrown and they love local, buying local. So I think they've ticked a lot of right boxes there, the club and the board of the club, and the fact that they're getting him to run it is a really good idea, because like all of us, if it's your idea, it's the best idea in the world, so you'll push more.
That's right.
So I think innovations like that, tapping into local community and local produce, I think they're great ideas.
Fantastic. Now, last question. Finish this sentence. Money makes
me happy.
We like that answer. Stephen, it's been a pleasure to interview you. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us.
Thanks very much, Michelle. I've really enjoyed it.
No dramas. And congratulations again on your new book. In fact, we're giving 5 books to give away to our readers. They can check it on our website. In the meantime, I'm looking forward to visiting your pub. But what's next for you? What are your future plans?
Continued growth, but sensible growth. Like my idea, people often say, do you want to have 100 pubs or how many pubs do you want to own? And quite simply, we want to only have pubs that we can provide a good service and atmosphere for our customers. So that might be 2 this year, it could be 10 next year, but as long as we've got the structures in place that we can provide the service, because if you don't, then you'll quickly not have any pubs anymore. So it's just kind of like a step-by-step gentle process for us.
I feel like it echoes your earlier comment about not over-capitalizing, so not overextending yourself.
Yeah, I like looking at Swiss cheese because it's got all those little holes in it, you know. And so I figure you just take little bits out, and then you've eventually eaten it all, but just piece by piece.
Piece by piece until you're the big cheese, like Stephen Hunt. Once again, all the best, and thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you, Michelle.
You're listening to Friends with Money podcast. Don't forget, if you want to find out what else we have in store, you can email us on money at moneymag.com.au.
Thanks for listening to the Friends with Money podcast. For credible, independent, and easy to understand financial commentary, visit moneymag.com.au. Please remember that the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are general in nature, and further independent advice and research based on your personal circumstances should be sought before making an investment decision.